Hello everyone, welcome to tonight's debate on the motion this House would make language learning compulsory. But before we get into that, do we have any council announcements to make? Anyone got anything they want to make?
Yes.
Do you? Yes.
Sorry, my phone's on charge, guys, sorry. I wasn't prepared. Right. Okay, so here we go. Getting the handy dandy spreadsheet up. Any new members? I'm Ellie, by the way. I'm the intern of the winger, so I organise the weekly debates and I try and get every single one of you to sign up and speak at debates. And I've been relatively successful this year, I'd say. I've had a lot of maiden speakers. And we're coming to the end of the term. So next week's debate is This House Believes Liberal Feminism Never Ditched Its Racist Roots. And there'll be some surprises coming there. We do still have two slots open for the other side, for the opposition, arguing that it did ditch its roots. So if you would like to sign up. And there will also be a female and gender minorities training workshop on Monday. So if you are a woman or a gender minority, non-binary like myself, and you want to go to a training exercise but you kind of feel a little bit daunted, or maybe like debate is generally not in this society, but outside of it is a really male-dominated, unfortunately. Right, nothing should be one gender-dominated, especially in university competitions and a lack of access for women into those opportunities. I know myself from doing debate in secondary school. I was one of the only girls in the whole competition back when I still identified as a girl, but anyway, on different things. So basically, if you would like to get into the world of debating, but just due to secondary schools and the general standard and other debating communities about debate, we have that opportunity for you, and it will be done by our amazing training officer, James Orchin, and I will also be there. So it'll be a good night. It is going to be at 8 p.m. on 7 p.m. on Monday. Details will be up on the Instagram with a lovely wee graphic. So you're all welcome to come along to that and sign up for the other debate. The debate after, since I know you all love signing up multiple weeks in advance, thank you for making my job easier, is the Christmas mini debates. And no one is signing up for that because each and every one of you will be involved in some way, and it will be fun, okay? And that's all my announcements. Thank you!
Yes.
So by council announcement this week is that on the 15th, so just after the mini debates that Ellie was talking about, we're going to have our annual Christmas dinner. This year it's going to be a bit more sort of informal, so it'll be just after the mini debates, which should, I think, only last about an hour. So we'll go to libraries, and we've got a section in the big pool room, so you have fight to eat and play ball and bring time to have a track and all the rest of it. So there is a sign up form for that on our Instagram, so you just need to click on the link on that and put in any badge requirements you have or all the rest of it, and then we can give libraries the numbers of people who are coming. So that's the first one. The second one is that I've also put together a sort of membership monitoring form. I think it's very important for the society to ensure that we are representative of the wider body of students at Queen's, that we, you know, have monitor the sort of, you know, demographics of the society, you know, see if we're, you know, going backwards in some areas, then we can address it, so that if there are, we're only appealing to politics students, for example, maybe we want to think about doing some debates like this one that don't just appeal to politics students. So that will be out at some point soon, so please fill that in so we can have a good idea of what the society's demographics are, and that will help inform council decisions next semester.
Thank you. Any other council announcements? Speak now or forever hold your peace. Thank you. So it's now my pleasure to welcome Josie to give the minutes from last week's debate. Give Josie a round of applause.
Hello everyone and welcome to tonight's debate. It's really great to see you all here. So on the 24th of November 2022, the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society convened for the 10th ordinary meeting of the 174th session for the motion, This House Regrets the Enlightenment. As usual, the meeting began with an announcement as Ellie Byrne, HLM, brought up the next week's debate. After a reading of the minutes, the meeting moved to private members' business. Jamie Warren presented the Scottish independence referendum. Responses were heard by Tom Burns, Owen Usher, Luke Maguire, Ryan Hoey, HLM, Ellie Byrne, HLM, James Orton, HLM, and Dermot Hamill. President's questions then commenced. James Orton, HLM, proposed that the society should acquire a sword to rival our Filsock counterparts. As after much extensive research, he had found a potential investment opportunity, being a samurai sword and two anime body pillows for just £150. Sounds like a steal. A vote of prior opinion then took place. There were 7 votes for aye, 18 votes for nay, and 11 abstentions. First on the proposition was Owen Usher. Owen began his speech by lowering the lights in the room, illustrating the way in which he would enlighten us through his speech. Through the Enlightenment, human ambition grew. However, Owen argued that we must place the Enlightenment in the context in which it was founded. The Enlightenment became the church of the mind, replacing the saints with intellectuals and God with ideas. He argued that with the growth of ambition, so did the greed of man. First in the opposition was Tom Burns. Tom first proposed that the Enlightenment brought us logic, reason, and exploration. This progression benefited humanity as a whole, from the arts to scientific advancements. Tom argued that without the Enlightenment, we would live in a world without the freedom of political thought, as our contemporary political spectrum was as a direct result of this movement. We have been able to quench our thirst for knowledge, opposing historical tyranny. Second on the proposition was Jacqueline Bonner. Jacqueline proposed that the Enlightenment had a direct impact on the treatment of women, citing the witch hunts as being spurred on by this movement. She stated that the mass hysteria was perpetuated by this persecution, sorry, that's a lot of P's, as well as destroying the art of herbal and hippie medication. Despite the advancement of science, education, and free thought, this had no benefit to us. Instead, Jacqueline proposed that we should all return to absolute monarchy. Second on the opposition was Jack Hanlon. First, Jack stated that our ability to engage in reason and free political thought is a privilege brought on by the Enlightenment. This was ultimately a natural, logical evolution from a faith-centric belief system, with liberty being a core value presented within post-Enlightenment thought. Faith was not destroyed by the Enlightenment. Instead, people chose to accept a new philosophical thought. Jack concluded that to oppose the Enlightenment is direct opposition to the beauty of the human spirit. Third on the proposition was Luke Maguire. Luke presented rebuttal to the opposition's argument, stating that logic was actually first proposed by Greek philosophers. He stated that the founders of the Enlightenment were very introspective, being slaves to their passions and urges. Ultimately, Enlightenment makes people grow fat under a false god, putting our own happiness at the expense of others. Third on the opposition was Katie Hughes. She began by arguing that the Enlightenment provided the building blocks for the future, being a key catalyst for change. The Enlightenment was the coming of age for humanity, breaking away from faith and monarchy, triumphing democracy, and paving the path for modern day political thought. Katie proposed that the opposition to the Enlightenment is an object reaction of modern science and reason. The final speaker on the proposition was Orkin McSparran. First, Orkin stated that the scientific and political advancements of the Enlightenment had a dangerous impact on our livelihood. The development of chemical weapons and the numerous wars spurred on by the Enlightenment has made this world far less safe. He presented how democracy is pitched as valuing everyone's opinions equal. However, this is blatantly not true. Stalin, Napoleon, and Putin only care for their own ambitions. Ultimately, enlightened thought promoted this ideology. And the final speaker on the opposition was Dermot Hamill. First, he stated the flaws in the proposition's argument, stating that the motion has been misunderstood and that there has been no arguments illustrating a world in which the Enlightenment had not taken place. Dermot presented the Christian Crusades, in which 9 million people were killed in the name of religion. Either we could live in a nice feudalistic society or forget science and all die of cholera. To regret the Enlightenment, is to regret the emergence of human rights, art, and scientific developments. After deliberation by the judges, they presented Katie Hughes as the winner of the 2022 Godkin debate. May I take the minutes as read?
Aye.
Thank you very much, Josie. It's now my pleasure to turn our attention to private members' business. Okay. Private members' business for the evening. So if you have a point to make, you can raise your hand now. State your name for the minutes, please.
Sir Mahal. I just wanted to address the emergence of Christmas markets in Belfast. As someone that has found myself dabbling into them more than a few times, German strawberry beer is actually quite nice. I wanted to ask the House whether they thought the price of £6 for a pint is an acceptable thing in a modern cost of living crisis.
Thoughts on pint prices? Yes, state your name for minutes, please.
Ellie Byrne, HLM.
What was that?
HLM. I'm a favourite cider person. You know, you get some really nice cider. It's £1 to £8.45 in most bars.
Yeah.
So like, if I could get a favourite cider for £6 in the Christmas market, I would actually be pretty happy. Just to be quite honest, because like, I don't, you know, is there a much of a feel out there, you know?
Tackling the real political issues all day. Yes, state your name for the next one.
I'd say if £6 for a pint beer from London, that's nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, do you have the minutes, please?
Well, Kirsten, so as someone who did partake in the festivities, aka I got a stein and I really shouldn't have, because I'm a wee type, essentially, I ended up, it depends what your goal is for the evening. If you want to, like, sample a wider range of beers, I think that's fair enough price. But if you want to get hammered, there's a place called Witherspoon. However, my friend found a bit of a cheat sheet to this. Now, if you guys don't know, Oktoberfest beer is 6.2%. So if you're having a stein of that, you're going to have fun that evening, and then not so much fun the next evening. My friend then ended up buying a drinking horn that was made out of a cow tusk, which, because he wanted to be a Viking for a day, I guess, and that cost him £30. But then we ended up going up the road to Santeria, where the average drink was about the same price, or £8. So to be honest, it's there for about a month. Why not?
You've been itching to go, so yes, to go for the next few.
HLM.
I didn't mention it.
I think 2 points. So firstly, on the first point, Jeremy, I would have thought, of all people, you'd be in favour of having a large amount food in one area, because there's going to be food drop on the floor and become trash, which will naturally attract your favourite animal in the world. But I have a point here, and it's quite a heart-wrenching story about being going to the Christmas market. I imagine me as a small child going along, and then the parents saying, oh, you know what, you'll love the German sausages, especially the cheese one. So I went in, got it, bit into it, and I then burnt my lip on molten cheese. Okay.
There's so many.
This is what Germans do.
Yes, sit in with the minutes, please.
Jack Hamlin, what I'm hearing about is a lot of people in this room who can afford to go to the Christmas
market.
Okay. Let me tell you something, right? Get a large living room, get all your mates, LED lights, right? 12 pack of heart, and get a George Foreman and a packet of Denny sausages. You got it.
I'm not allowed to have a political opinion, but I would agree with that. Yes.
Ellie Byrne.
Say it.
What do you call it? Thank you for specifying. I usually like to walk around this market. One thing I used to be one of those really annoying like school students because I never was in school. In my home for the Christmas market and free samples you can get from Christmas market. Like, yes, I'll try that later. Yes, I'll try this fudge. I walk around. around 4 different times and I'm full, like, and it's free. So, like, that part of me loves it, but, you know, the scrounger. And then the other part is, if any of you know about me and my runs about my partner, Josh, who isn't here last night, he is alive and well. No one would believe, right? I have fed this man ghost chilies and he's bought, asked me if it was pepper. Okay, now this guy, he can taste things, okay? He knows when I add too much salt to the chili, but he can't taste spice. And as someone who can handle a medium level at Nando's at best, it's not ridiculous. I walked into the Christmas market and what was the first thing I seen? This massive stand of 30 different types of hot sauce. The world, you know the hot ones?
Yeah.
They have the sauce they use in the hot
no
ones.
Way.
Yes, they did. I bought 5 bottles of that, 5 or 8 a bottle, and I tell you when I got home, I made chili con carne, and she was like, what are you cooking tonight? You're like, you were at work and you don't cook tonight, so why don't you cook? And I'm like, oh, thank you, well, I just felt like I'm cooking tonight, you know, I just really love and appreciate you. Half a bottle went into that chili.
That's cruel.
You know what? No, because you know what his response was? You finally got a little kick to it.
No, he'll feel the kick tomorrow morning. That's
no, this was a week and a half ago. He like, no. Yeah.
This is not.
He's not feeling it anyway, so I'm glad that the Christmas market has finally brought me something, because the guy said if that didn't work, he had this flat bottle, which is like half the size, but it's actually the concentrated ingredient, which makes that chili spicy. So he said if that doesn't work, to come back, he'll give me it for half price. So, I went back and got for half price, and tomorrow night I'm cooking dinner. And I don't know if it's necessary how that goes, but I am really happy about that. So, that's one good thing that this market has brought for me personally.
You just love her,
this is the weirdest session of podcast ever. I'm not coming to you again.
What's a small point?
It's never a small point. Yes.
I just want to say, I'm condolences, Ellie, on breaking up. Tomorrow night, it's going to be really shame.
I want to give him some context to this. He is always asking me to make stuff spicy. He's asking me to make stuff spicier, so I'm not doing this against his will. He wants spicy food. He makes fun of me for not being able to make stuff spicy enough for him. Okay? So he is fine. He is happy. Alright?
Absolutely not. No. Yes, please get us back on track, please. Stay here for the minutes, please.
I wanted to defend my honour about my speech last week, because in the minutes it's listed that I said we should return to monarchy. And not a monarchist. I said return to monkey. There is a slight difference, and I just love it.
Thank you. Do we have any other points that aren't related to the Christmas market or hot sauce, or something that's not actually relevant? Yes.
I was just wondering what's happening about Kanye West sitting down for dinner with Donald Trump last week and quoting him to be vice president in the 2024 election.
Yes. State your name for the minutes, please.
No, hardly. It wasn't just Donald Trump that met with Kanye West. It was also Nicolas J. Fuentes.
Yeah.
So the mix of Kanye West's inevitable Hebrew Israelite and white nationalism of Nick Fuentes has come up with quite a unique political flavor that I'm very, very eager to see.
Yes, state your name for the minutes, please.
Well, thank you for inserting Kanye West and I after our flop tonight. I think he's kind of ignored the problem. First off, I don't understand why he still has a massive platform as he did. I do think it's funny that after his brand deal with whatever company, he tried to walk into Skechers, which is a Jewish-owned company, and the front doors for shooting him. So good on Skechers. I might actually buy a pair now. No, I don't. I buy them my mom usually, but not anymore. Then second of all, it's like American politics just depresses me as a politician. I'm like, I already have to go through politics at level, and I have a weekly topic test, and I have to pay attention to divorce and Trump's tweets, and I have to keep up to date with them. That was a pain enough during A levels. I'm doing a politics degree. I really have to keep up more with Kanye West and Donald Trump. And I'm like, please,
yes.
Can we fix this?
Stay in for the minutes, please.
Yeah, my name's Kira Twill. KHLN, lol. So essentially, I think it kind of talks about how America is the perfect example of populism gone absolute insanity, where essentially instead of actual politics, it's become this almost meme scheme where most politicians are trying to say certain things to get airtime, and that's what it's about. Where, like, for example, I don't know if any of you have had the displeasure of having to study Tucker Carlson for a month, but like, it's essentially gotten to the point where I remember I was doing a debate on American politics and I had to watch Fox News and CNN, and I've never seen so much absolute tripe in all my life, because there's no substance to it. It was essentially buzzwords galore of us versus them's. And like, I think it represents kind of the dangers of populism, of just being a brand, and that is your political way into office.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Jack Conlon. I want to actually focus on one part of that thing where it was like, yes, Donald Trump met with Kanye West, haha, very funny. But I think it's more concerning the fact that he met with Nick Fuentes.
Oh, you see, yeah.
Because when you're dealing with Kanye West, is someone who, in my opinion, is clearly suffering from mental health issues on top of having reprehensible beliefs. That's fine. Nick Fuentes knows exactly what he's mm-hmm. doing. He's a concentrated, alt-right person who's directly trying to influence the media. He was the platform from every single platform. What does that say about how America deals with the rise of fascism, in that he has to prove from every single platform, yet he gets to have a direct audience with an ex-president, and we can still consider Kanye to be an influential celebrity. He's lost his economic capital, but he has not lost his social or cultural capital. He's still held in regards to music. You get a lot of people, oh, Kanye's a fascist, or it's not as well, but his music's really good. People will still want Kanye at their side, in a way, they'll still Kanye's part of their life. And the fact that Nick Fuentes is allowed to float around within even the hemisphere of these people who still have a very big grasp in the media is extremely concerning.
State your name for minutes, please.
So, as someone who has actually, and I'll preface this because it would sound really bad if I don't give the context. So, when I was over in America, me and my friend, who's born in Brazil, but he lived in America, we were walking through this hotel in Virginia, and who happens to be walking down the corridor in this direction, Nick Fuentes and Richard Spencer, two of the most reprehensible in terms of their views in the world. So I actually didn't know who Nick Fuentes was at the time, but my friend did, and went over and had an argument with both of them. But having been, when he told me who he was, and then I went and looked up, he's got some terrible, like some of the stuff that he said online is, like, he was at the Charlotte Bill rally as well. I think that's how he became famous. Yeah, he was the organizer. And I think what happened was that I don't think that he was actually on the invitation list, but he was going to be plus one. But I think it's really bad for Trump, who's already, after the recent elections, going down the list in terms of those who would be the Republican nominee, to if he came along with Kanye, to then allow him to sit down and have dinner with him. So I really hope that he's not the Republican nominee in 2024, because he's gone really beyond the pale, beyond the pale at this point.
Thank you. I'll take one more, if it's somewhat appropriate.
It's not a lot. I just think it speaks to a greater point that America is extremely polarised, and Joe Biden can say he wants to unite as much as he wants, but he's done fuck all to do it, so he has to know there's no one to keep it in.
I trust you, and you never ever do. Thanks. Thank you. And that concludes Private Member's Business for tonight.
Okay,
it's all right, so you've already had your chance. It's my displeasure to... You could have asked points of private members, but this is not a quick question for me. There's like people here who could have definitely asked a question. This is president's questions. So this is whenever you get to ask me a question. Which really should be you instead of me, but...
Stimulate.
Yes. State your name for the minutes, please.
Hi,
Ellie Byrne.
Why are you smiling at me like that?
Have you eaten today?
I have. I had Weed-Vix my breakfast today. I did, yeah.
Did you have lunch and dinner as well?
I had lunch, yeah. Weed-Vix is nice. Why? What's with the Weed-Vix here?
Every single Thursday
night. Well, I do. I do. Yes. Say your name for minutes, please.
Are there any updates
regarding the sword? The sword is currently dispatched to my house. It will be here on the 16th of December or before then. If it arrives before then, I will knight you with the sword at the last debate. I don't know if it'll be here before then or not. This is setting a fantastic precedent to our guest. Yes.
The sword is about to make the answer so much better. Right, just on the topic of Nick Fuentes earlier, my flatmate showed me a video of a Nick Fuentes live stream where Nick Fuentes, as some of you may or may not know, is a virgin and was being accused of being a virgin. He made the adamant point that because he is a virgin, he is the least gay man in the world. Do you agree with this?
just give me a minute there. What? Does he actually believe
this? He's so genuinely homophobic that he doesn't have sex with women. That's the only thing he said this on his
He said that any woman who's ever been alive has at one point touched a man. Therefore, yeah. You're indirectly touching a man. Therefore, you.
Well, I think he's absolutely right. Yes.
It's not
but better not be, because I'll answer it.
Who do you want to win the World Cup?
Ooh.
Nobody. Actually, probably Scotland, but they're probably not even in the World Cup, so.
No.
So I don't really care.
We'll just say.
But Wales are going to be out of it within. Like, they lost England. I'd say anyone except England is who I want to win the World Cup. Right. There's no more, thank God. Right, so before we go to the rate of fire opinion, I'll just do it now. I'd like to welcome our guest chair for the evening, who is probably thinking, what the hell am I here for after this? So this is Professor Margaret Topping. Margaret Topping is Professor of French Literary and Visual Cultures at Queen's University Belfast. She completed her undergraduate and postgraduate studies at Oxford University, gaining a joint honours degree in French and Spanish, and a doctorate in philosophy. She previously taught at Oxford University and joined the Modern Languages team at Queen's in 2011. Her research trajectory has developed from an early disciplinary focus on one of France's most famous writers, Marcel Proust, to a firmly interdisciplinary approach to debates linked to travel, tourism and migration, and the ethics and aesthetics of cross-cultural representation. Additionally, Margaret benefits from the executive board membership of the Irish Humanities Alliance, serving as honorary treasurer for the Association of University Professors and Heads of French, in addition to her role on the Executive Committee for the Society for French Studies, which includes the particularly massive responsibility of chairing the international panel which awards the prestigious Malcolm Bowie Prize. Finally, Margaret also serves as the trustee for the local organization, the Turnaround Project, which aims to utilize enterprise startups to give people in the criminal justice system the opportunity to experience and demonstrate competency in real jobs and real businesses before and after they complete their sentences. It is my great pleasure to welcome Margaret Topping to the
with your research, and I am actually wondering if I should make a run for it. I don't think that I can bring the hilarity or eloquence to the table tonight that I think is kind of the norm here, but I'm looking forward to the debate. Yes, thank you so much, first of all, for the invitation to be here tonight and the introduction. The motion is certainly particularly close to my heart because, as was said, I'm a professor of French. And my other role in the university is as Pro Vice Chancellor for Internationalisation, which means that part of my role is to try and increase the diversity of our student population on the campus. And part of that is also valuing the benefits of
intercultural communication, contact, and so on. And so linguistic diversity is a really key part of that, and we have our own particular questions in Queen's because of the range of local languages that we are also celebrating. So in terms of the motion itself, that the House believes that language learning should be compulsory, we've certainly talked about a crisis in modern languages for as long as I've been teaching modern languages, which is probably about 20 years. And we have often said that the way to deal with that is to make language learning compulsory. And I'm sure that others will have the arguments here on the table, but some of what has been said, and even in most recent reports, 2020 report from HEPI, the Higher Education Policy Institute, talks about an EU-wide survey showing that just 32% of young people in the UK are able to read or write in more than one language, compared with 79% of their peers in France, more than 90 in Germany, so we're way behind. So the author of the report, Megan Bowler, calls for the overturning of the government's 2004 decision to drop compulsory study of languages at key stage four. So now we don't have students having to take languages at GCSE level, and that has seen a massive decline in terms of the numbers going on to study languages at college and university. Nick Hillman, HEPI's director, said that making foreign languages optional at GCSE was the worst education policy blunder in recent memory. I'm hopefully not saying what you're going to say.
Well,
and that really
is
stating it was
such a huge no-brainer.
I think you're going to say it better than me. That reinstating it was a total no-brainer, but the reality is that fewer than half of all pupils in England, Wales and Northern Ireland sit at GCSE in a foreign language. There's a perception that it's a hard subject, so we're not going to do it. So the report says that we need to do things differently, that we need to reinstate the making it compulsory, we maybe need to do alternative qualifications, maybe more vocational language usage, and so on. But the starting point is that there's a crisis recognised, and our starting point is always, let's make it compulsory to have language learning beyond this. The situation is even worse in Northern Ireland in the sense that we only have compulsory language learning at key stage three, so only in that age 11 to 14 period. So this is the shortest time frame for compulsory language learning in any country in the continent of Europe. It's not good. So the calls are out there, the response is, make it compulsory. We know the arguments for the value of learning languages. Neil Kenny, professor of French and also the languages lead at the British Academy, talks about even, particularly in the context of Brexit, languages are vital for trade, diplomacy, soft power, social cohesion, he says, social mobility, educational attainment, all of what we need. We also know that language learning goes far beyond the pure linguistic transaction. Even in our own culture here, it's central to questions of belonging and cultural identity. Research has talked about languages opening up a new mental landscape, a new way of thinking. They're linked to questions of global citizenship. And for me also, intercultural awareness is what promotes, or that is core to language learning. It is core also to ethical engagement with other cultures. It's about recognising human rights and how they exist in different cultural contexts. It's about cultural relativism and a non-normative understanding of behaviours and ways of being. There's also been new research in neuroscience that has shown that it increases your brain power to learn languages. So we've got all the arguments, so why don't we just make it compulsory? Part of me is really tempted to say, yeah, just do it. I get that. But I've got a nice quotation from Plato who says that knowledge which is acquired under compulsion obtains no hold on the mind. So that's the argument against it. My question back then to us as language learners is, maybe the challenge is a different one. The response is not to make it compulsory. Maybe we as language educators need to think about teaching it differently, conceiving of it differently, and inspiring our learners differently. There's my starter for 10.
Thank you very much, Professor. Also, we are very, very grateful that this debate is a co-hosted debate with the Spanish Portuguese Society and the French Society. I know that, Hannah, you want to say something about the Spanish Portuguese Society, so I'll let you grant the floor to you for a few minutes now. So thank you. Give her a big round of applause.
I'm a final year student. I study Spanish and Portuguese here at Queen's, and I'm the events manager for the Spanish and Portuguese Society. We're a society made up mainly of just students of Spanish and Portuguese, or we also have French and Portuguese students, or people who are doing Spanish and French, and that's mainly the committee of the society are language students. However, we have loads of members in our society who do not study languages, are from here, maybe did a language at GCSE or A level and want to keep it up. We also have a lot of international students whose native language would be Spanish or Portuguese. And our society is really just for everyone who has any kind of interest in keeping up their language that they might have done at GCSE or A level. We do intercambios every few weeks, and it's a chilled, relaxed environment and an opportunity to have a wee chat with either the native speakers or just other students, and it's always very, very relaxed and there's no pressure. It's not like an oral class or nothing. You can have just a very small conversation, and we kind of even switch back and forth into English and then to our target language, and it's very relaxed. And we do a lot of like cultural events. We have a little Christmas event coming up next week, and we'll do event to celebrate the carnival in February, among other things. And it's just a great way to keep yourself immersed in the language, because especially if you are a language student, your classes can kind of get a bit overwhelming and boring and you feel pressured. So our society just allows a very chill, relaxed and fun way to keep up your language practice, and it's really for anyone to come along. And if you want more information, you can go onto our Instagram. It's QBSpanPortSoc, and that's all I have to say about it.
Thank you. I don't know if anyone from the French Society is here. If anyone is from the French Society that wants to speak, they can speak now. Otherwise, I will move on. No? Okay. But we're very grateful to both societies for helping us organise this event. Now, we turn our attention to the vote on prior opinion. So, this is the vote on your perspective on the motion. So, how do you think? Should we make language learning compulsory, should we not? If you think we should make language learning compulsory, you can raise your hand now. Yeah, 20. If 20. You... 22?
That's not what I got.
If you think we should not make language learning compulsory, you can raise your hand now.
I love how we go down certain political lines.
Well, if you want to abstain on the motion, you can raise your hand now.
Five.
Josie, do you have the numbers?
Yes. So there were 22 votes for aye, 12 for nay, and 5 abstentions.
Thank you. And now I will invite Margaret to introduce the first speaker for the proposition. Sorry.
Hello everybody. I just want to say that was a fantastic speech from Professor Topping. It was kind of a double-edged sword for me because it was so eloquently put, but it covered so many of my points. Woefully uneducated, but I'm going to do my absolute best. So first of all, I'm just going to say we, the proposition, define this motion as follows. It should be mandatory in all schools from primary up to GCSE level on a par with subjects such as English and maths to be engaged in language learning. So I'm going to start this off with a quote that I actually hold quite dear in my heart, that the foundation of every state is the education of its youth. That's Diogenes. Without jumping straight into language relations in terms of the state, first of all, I'll bring up that I myself am actually from a bilingual family background. I do not speak English quite natively with my family. I prefer to speak in Irish with my family, as I was raised as such. I speak with my dad, my brother, and my sister, usually over the phone, which is quite uncomfortable on certain bus rides to certain places with the word Abbey at the end of them. But I find that through this, I consider myself a direct beneficiary of cultural enrichment through this. I found a deeper connection with my family and with my Irish heritage through speaking Irish. I can't even describe the sort of sense of community that I get with it as well. The ability to engage in Irish-speaking commons within Belfast. I don't often do it, but whenever I do, I always remember that it was exactly compulsory language learning through education that did it. Because the thing is about my family, despite them all being bilingual, is that my parents are not educators. My parents are not teachers. They could not teach me this language themselves, as much as they may have wanted to. My dad has self-taught himself. So they sent me to an Irish school, an Irish primary school, where obviously language learning for both English and Irish is compulsory. And I found that without that, I would not have the connection to the language that I do now. There's obviously that kind of phonetic connection that you have in terms of a speaking language with your parents. But I really feel like you can't connect with a language if you don't understand its structure, where it comes from, its history. And I feel that I really benefited from that. No, not now. I'll go back to you later. So I'm just going to get through this first wee bit here. So, children raised bilingual on average, as the professor said, are capable of a lot more academically in terms of increased activation in the brain region associated with cognitive skills and attention and inhibition. I know that's quite a mouthful to get through, but I am of the genuine belief that children who are raised with the opportunity to be bilingual and who are put in a situation where they are maybe made to avail of it will benefit in the long run, especially in terms of employability in modern Europe. We have other countries which do not, we're not on the same level as them whenever it comes to bilinguality and multilinguality in terms of the thing. I went to Holland myself and I had a really cool interaction where there was three people in the line. There was myself, a gentleman in front of me, and then there was someone serving, and the person serving served the first person in Dutch, the second in Arabic, and then me in English. And I never felt so stupid in my life, coming from the United Kingdom, in that I can't speak any of these languages whatsoever. I can barely even speak English. I felt quite embarrassed. I feel like compulsory language learning in schools doesn't necessarily force people in order to do it. If anything, I think it's inherently beneficial to, especially pre-adolescents, to be placed in any type of compulsory education program. I found from my own personal experience that compulsory education programs, especially with attendance programs, really genuinely helped keep me on the right track at school. I was a horrific student. I was suspended multiple times because of my behavior, but because of these compulsory education systems, which one of them being language systems, I find an actual genuine love for learning. And especially yes, go ahead.
What about the millions of students out there who don't like languages, who don't want to do it, who are gonna scrap it as soon as they can, and you're wasting their time instead of pursuing something that they're actually interested in and developing a hatred for the language because they're forced to learn it?
Now, I feel like the development of a hatred for a language as based out of a compulsory learning system isn't really a fair way to designate anything. I feel like, obviously, I'm very horrible at maths. I was compelled to learn maths in school. I hated doing maths in school. Do I hate mathematics? No, I do not. I don't hate the concept of mathematics. And in my later life, I've actually found, growing up, that my lack of ability to do mathematics, because I didn't engage in that compulsory program and I kept pulling away and skipping classes, I feel like a moron most days, especially in work when I have to give out change to someone, the till goes down and I'm sitting staring at my hand. And I feel like that's a very good analogy for whenever somebody is caught up in a situation where someone may be speaking to them in a language that they don't understand. Especially, I'd like to make the point that us being the only country in Europe where we are primarily monolingual, the majority of us speak English, I think that's obviously a fair designation that the majority of us are, but it's not really everybody, is it? The upper class students of Eton College and Oxbridge, coming from prep schools, and the multilingualism is a given. They will be taught in Latin, French, Spanish. Those kinds of opportunities aren't often there for working class students.
One last point.
Yes?
Please tell me then, with a shortage of language teachers, how you propose to fill every single school in the country up until GCSE, and even the work current system doesn't have enough teachers to fill the spaces that we're still trying to fill.
If we're talking about people who engage within the PGC certificate program in learning and becoming language teachers for working class students, I feel like opening the barrier and allowing the fact that there can be language teachers in working class schools. So say we begin teaching working class students say we get a working class student who's learning French and they've been taught French in a compulsory thing. Say they fall in love with the language. What might they do? They may go and get a PGC certificate and become a French teacher in working class schools. This is, I don't know. Obviously, I'm speaking out of conjecture there, but that would be, I would genuinely believe that that could be a process that happened. Let me see if I've just covered all my points. Sorry. Yes, also, just on the point earlier about people hating the language, I understand that. I hated a lot of subjects in school. I don't feel that that's a fair, I don't think that's fair to apply to every single child that is put into a compulsory learning system. Just because you hate a certain subject that you do, you shouldn't take that opportunity away from other children. There's many, many people. It's like going to the gym. Not, it's something that you kind of need to do, and not everybody will like it, and not everybody will realize that they like it until they at least try it. I feel that that is a very good analogy for language learning. I'm going to finish up here. Thanks for that.
First of all, the opposition is Terence.
Mr. President, the Chair, Professor Topping, members of the committee, the opposition, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. I stand for you tonight here as a victim and a survivor of compulsory language learning. Things were different back then. The past is still a different country. And when I walked into Mr. Maguire's Latin class, yes, Latin, you did hear that correctly, up there at Brackenbur House, preparatory school for boys, off the Malone Road, I had images that would be similar to my previous excursions into other languages, namely French and Irish, where singing songs, being tempered with exciting stories of derring do from Reynard the Fox to Cú Chulainn, were the order of the day. Alas, it was not to be. Mr. Maguire was of the Marine Corps School of Pedagogy, and things had to be done correctly from the ground up. Thence followed 4 years, 4 years of Latin grammar that resembled, for this dyslexic, King Minos's labyrinth for containing the Minotaur in Crete. Lined up in our short trousers, we had to show proficiency in all tenses, the present, the past, the perfect, the imperfect, and something called the pluperfect, which doesn't even exist in English by that name. Otherwise, it was get the Starbuck boy! Bellowed out, bull-like fashion, and these were not the type of stars you wanted to get. The disgrace, the shame, the mortification as one walked with the accursed book to have one's hand in one's name inscribed. To this day, the hair in the back of my neck raises an alarm when I hear a verb being put through its conjugating calisthenics. Yes,
sir. Is this a criticism of language learning or a criticism of inefficient and bad language learning in terms of the teacher that you were given?
Good point. I've thought about it. And I understand that things were done differently. Pass is another country. That is how it was done. Please listen carefully because I do have points about your chosen language later on. And we'll talk about that. So listen carefully. Moving forward a couple of decades, and whilst training to be an English teacher, English, in Galway, I was compelled to take Irish, as all teachers in Ireland had to pass an Irish proficiency test. It's called the Ceart Testis. Even for the teaching of English. Needless to say, I failed. And despite having a qualification to teach, in one hand, I was forced to emigrate for decades more. Now, 30 years of teaching, I can honestly say that perhaps the most inventive, engaging, and determined teachers that I have had the pleasure to see work are the foreign language teachers, including ESL teachers. And by God, they have to be, to take those resistant young minds and instill therein a knowledge that may go against every grain of the fiber of their being. And the most salient thing they do is show how a language actually works. Nuts and bolts, grammar and poetry. They do this because they understand the necessity of deconstructing a language to make it comprehensible. And they do this in ways that many teachers of English, believing that because it is their native tongue, their charges have picked up many of these skills by osmosis. So, hence the sentence, neither the red nor the blue bicycle are mine. would have an ESL teacher raising their eyeballs heavenward, knowing that using neither nor without a prepositional phase and a plural demands a singular verb. Neither the red bicycle nor the blue bicycle is mine. Now, how do you get that across to hormonally charged and Instagram reel addicted? Now, there's the rub. What we're proposing is far from discouraging additional learning of global languages, is to promote it extensively, but draw the line at making it compulsory. Just visualize it, brothers and sisters. As opposed to being illiterate or semi-literate in two languages, we could have students who have, after consultation, opted out of foreign languages and walk into an English classroom where the teacher reassigned the language department with all their wonderful grammatical skills, proven pedagogy, and inventive strategies awaits them to set them right on the road to English language excellence. Let me speak briefly on an experiment which I believe will substantiate the point. 101 years ago, the Irish Free State was formed, and 100 years ago, legislation was passed mandating school attendance for all between the ages of 5 and 14. Included in this, and to the specific end of creating a Gaelic state in the near future, the teaching of Irish is made compulsory. So after 100 years of this experiment, how many Irish speakers does the state boast? According to Wikipedia, apparently it's about a third of the population self-reporting on the 2016 census. Yet when we were recently in Dublin, I heard no mellifluous Gaelic being spoken. During the 10 years I lived there, there was, if you heard Irish, it was a head-turning rarity. It was not the Irish-speaking prowess of the population that brought the international powerhouses and wealth generators to Ireland. It was, among other things, the fluency and education in English spoken in that state. Gael Sumana, where the medium of instruction is in all subjects Irish, are well attended. But look closer and you'll find it's not all Abigail goers, but bourgeois parents keen to avoid the hoi polloi and the riffraff of general schools. Much as non-Catholics in other parts of the world purposely send their children to Catholic schools for the quality of education. As for learning, it is best when engaged involuntarily and with tangible goals within reach, carrots rather than sticks, so to speak. The literary character Flashman reflected that the best linguistic lessons were done on pillow talk after moments of intimacy with a native speaker in the target language. Look it up. Christopher Kinnihan, Christie to his friends, that famous Irish entrepreneur and international businessman, has degrees in Russian and Spanish, which he took at taxpayer expense while he spent 6 years in Mountjoy prison. He used these linguistic skills, along with a certain ruthless je ne sais pas, to forge considerable criminal empire in Spain. I'm not sure of his current whereabouts, and it could be worth $5 million to you if you do, but he has been linked to Dubai and Zimbabwe, where I have no doubt he continues to learn the lingua. In conclusion, there are many disciplines competing for the precious access to our young people's minds. The only two that are universally acknowledged as paramount are literacy in the spoken tongue of the native country and numeracy. All else are subject to the whims or politics of educators. I was educated at the tail end of the classics when they were revered. Now, not even this institution has got a classics department. Language learning is essential to communication and is a wonderful asset to be bi or trilingual, as many people are. Yet it is not essential in today's globalized society where technology stands ready to translate. And I whisper this, English is the most widely spoken language in the world. It is better, as I stated earlier, to be literate in one language, the mother tongue, rather than to be semi-literate or illiterate in two. Bell, we might disagree.
Okay,
I think.
Our second proposition is from Harriet Shaw.
Hi, so to start, I'm going to try and do something a bit more contemporary and hopefully concise than the black and white speech we just had. So to that, I'll start with, bonsoir, mes amis. C'est le plaisir de me dresser à vous à notre beau président Mathieu. Et mon nom, l'argument pour la proposition ce soir. Now, I don't know if you could tell, I can't speak French at all. And I was assisted by the lovely Kira with my pronunciation, but it's actually with great regret that I couldn't say that myself. I spent 5 years being taught French as a compulsory subject at GCSE level, and I finished with an F, and no, that doesn't stand for French. The point I'd like to raise is that even with language being compulsory, it is down to the individual if they will engage with academia themselves. I was given that opportunity, like many others, and that opportunity should be available to everyone whether they know whether to take it yet or not. Many decisions are made for students by the academic bodies for them as to what's in their best interest. For example, what core subjects are mandatory to study and how many additional subjects they can take. Who is to say a young mind is capable of seeing utility in a second language at that selfish age of their lives? As a young, bigoted, gammon-skinned Englishman, I certainly didn't. As I do now, as a gammon-skinned Englishman. The importance of being taught a second language in our ever-shrinking world couldn't be more apparent. Globalization is going to continue and our world will continue to shrink. As that happens, the necessity of common tongues to communicate effectively as a species is paramount. To disregard language learning at an educational level will slow down and cause friction on development that could have otherwise been made much faster with more integrated and interwoven communities. Humans didn't thrive. Yep, go ahead.
So your point about how we're all getting more interconnected and to reduce friction, would it not be better then to have mandatory political education that way we can reduce friction that way?
How would we communicate with everyone if no one could understand each other?
Most people speak English.
No.
Humans didn't thrive through their claws or teeth, but by communicating with their speech. We weren't the strongest or most adapted sapiens, but we were able to use our minds and our mouths to build cities and empires. British, guilty as charged. To see language learning as a throwaway option is to disregard it as worthless, and to suppress language is to suppress the individual for who they are. If we are unable to communicate with those around us, expressing ourselves and our ideas, to cut off the ability to be able to speak with a whole new people at its grassroots within education is wrong and not a choice that we should make alone.
Please tell me, at this current level, if you've done GCSE, please tell me how well a conversation with a native French speaker would go.
Did you hear me at the start? Pretty bad. And also, my final point will also address that. To finish up, I'd like to point back to my terrible French I began with. If you would not like to be tortured again by such awful mispronunciation and faux accents, make sure everyone learns better than me. Thank you.
No, it's grand.
Here, sweat.
So, hello everyone. I am standing before you as someone who went through the language learning system and went all the way to France, where I taught it. I taught English in a country where with the exact same system that they propose, and I'm going to tell you how well that went. So the first thing I'm going to say is that there's a lot of gaps on that side. They haven't told us how they're going to facilitate this kind of introduction of language, making it mandatory into GCSE level. Now, and it ignores a lot of reasons why people don't take up language. One of those reasons being it's seen as a difficult subject, and why would people take a subject that they are probably going to fail in? And the second thing is we don't have the teachers to teach it. So how the hell are they expecting... wait for it. So essentially, the first thing I'm going to talk about is, at the moment, say you're a student going in to take GCSEs, right? So you're sitting there going, okay, what is going to get me a job and what is going to get me into uni? Do I go for the subject that's known statistically as being harsher mark than the rest? Do I go into a subject where if I go to A level, I have to go from je commence en chien to reading 18th century French literature? No, thank you. So, for example, with me, at this moment in time, what GCSE people are confronted with is, okay, I've learned to talk about hobbies, I've learned about basic stuff. Then, if they wanted to continue that, which I think is what you would like, to have more people do GCSE to then go on and continue it further. At this point, they go straight into learning about Boule de Suif. And I would know a lot about that, actually, because it was written in, I believe, 1795, and a book that I studied at university level. And yet we're expecting children to study it when they have probably quite a lower level than we have now. No, thank you. Now, and they don't want to continue it on because at the end of the day, they want to get into university. They want to get those grades, get into university, and they want the subject that essentially they can learn, yes, but also get the grades in to continue on. So I think a far more approachable situation than disbanding the entire thing and let's get a bunch of language teachers in that don't exist is, I don't know, make it more approachable to students. No. Now, the second thing that I'm going to go on to, which is a massive gaping hole in their plan, is how do we bring all these teachers in? Because I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but we have a shortage of language learning teachers at this moment in time. And this is for a couple of reasons. First of all, people don't want to do teaching as a profession.
On that point.
Oh, go for it.
Is this in contrast with the Department for the Education Report, which suggests that Northern Ireland produces 120 teachers for the 100 that we require? We have too many teachers as is.
Oh, fantastic. Please tell me about the shortages in England, Scotland, Wales. We do have an abundance of teachers, but we have a specific shortage in language teachers, which is what's important. And this is for a couple of reasons. First of all, they don't get, their bursary has been completely cut. The second reason is EU visas are far more difficult to come by nowadays. And the third reason is, if I'm a native speaker in a foreign language and I learned English as a second language, why the hell would I want to become a teacher that doesn't pay that well for really bad hours when I could, I don't know, work for the EU or work in business, which is what I do. Right, so we're not really making it very accepting to a lot of foreign language teachers to come in at the moment. They're suddenly expecting to magic everyone out of thin air. Now realistically, they're not going to magic people out of thin air. So what's going to happen is you're going to have a situation that I was confronted with in France when I was expected to teach a class of 30 children who did not care what I was saying whatsoever. No, thank you. So, I translated your documents. You are not sitting there. Anyway, so essentially, what happens is you get one teacher to about 30 students, right? 30, 40 students. And this would be grand if everyone's interested in you and engaging and wants to learn the language, but the majority don't. The majority don't want to be there. So guess what they do? They slack off. I'll tell you fantastic things that I dealt with when I was teaching in France. I had a student doing his art homework right in front of me. And when I complained about it, he went, Miss, let's be real. I'm not going to learn English. I don't want to learn English. So why shouldn't I spend this time doing art, which is something I'm passionate about? And I couldn't disagree with him. Then there was another girl who was expected to talk about immigration and, you know, the environment. And she said to me, "Miss, how do you say je pense in English?" For those of you who don't know, that means I think. And she was expected to talk about these complicated subjects. And let's be real, she said to me, she was like, "I don't know what I'm doing here. And I'm lost. I don't know anything." And I spent one-on-one time with her. But she was doing something she didn't want to do. And yet she could have spent that time doing other things. And it's so hard for the teacher as well, because instead of taking care of the students who were really passionate about the language, who were talented in it, who were speaking to me about video games, about things they enjoyed, I had to deal with the little shits in the corner who were essentially roughhousing, being like, "Yo, let's talk about memes," for the entire class, right? And so much so that I was there for 6 months, and it took me 3 months to discover that there was a student in my class who was completely fluent in English and talked about medical terms that I had never heard of before. Took me 3 months, because it took that much time to deal with the others that I couldn't focus on the people who wanted to be there. And that's why that's what their system would lead to. On focusing on the many, we sacrifice the few who actually want to be there and want to progress languages and who believe in languages. Thank you very much.
Okay, our third speaker for the proposition is Jake.
Sorry, the notebook's a little stubborn, so I have to position phones await. Excellent. So, after that speech, I think we need to clarify a few points about the original definition we gave. We made the point that we want language learning to be elevated to a position on a par with English and maths, and we acknowledge that this is a fundamental shift in how the education system works. As such, we don't expect teachers to magically materialise overnight. This would be a complicated government plan that would probably take years, if not over a decade, to implement, but it is an aspirational point that must be made. As such, apologies that we don't have a fully costed plan. However, that might be a few years. Ask me then, and we'll see how it goes. Additionally, I think an important point that was brought up at the beginning is the cultural capital of a language. The importance isn't so much in Aztec, pointed out the common utilisation of Irish, the importance in Irish language legislation was in ensuring the survival of the language, the continued study of it, and that might not have happened had the more privately charitable efforts of the Gaelic Revival been allowed to remain non-institutionalised. However, what I'd like to focus on here is the way changing the education system in this way could support current existing mandatory curricula, in particular English literature. Currently, we are seeing a major decline in the English A-level course. Naturally, it's mandatory up to GCSE level. However, after that point, we have seen since 2016, I believe it is, a 34% decline in the number of people who are taking that up. And English is a very important element from a cultural perspective. And it is falling by the wayside in a situation of economic hardship and a situation where there's a certain sense that this is focusing on the wrong things. The curtains are just blue is the common meme, as opposed to any deeper meaning in literature. Foreign language does not just provide an insight into the culture it belongs to, it can help to provide a view into your own. And that's especially true in the case of a language like English, where there are so many borrowings from foreign languages. We've had invasions from the French, from the Romans, the Scandinavians, and as a result, our language is kind of a mess. I remember there was an inquiry done by the military sometime in the last century where they attempted to create English words to replace terminology, and they discovered simply there are too many French words to get rid of. And even in common language, you can just see the remnants of this, like the word banal, boring, mundane. That makes more sense when you understand that there's a French term known as banalisation, banalization in a more English pronunciation, which means the process by which things become more normal over time. It adds depth to the word, a bit more context. However, in the same way, this can help to provide context to some of the most important literary texts in our history. And the point of an English language A-level, in an English language education as a whole, is to give a certain sense of tradition, of culture, and of history. For example, I remember when we finally got to A-level, we ended up looking at Middle English texts, such as Geoffrey Chaucer. In particular, it was The Partner's Tale. And it simply caught people off guard. The spelling is weird, and the pronunciation is even stranger. And I remember there was this particular sentence that our English teacher decided to give us, which just so many people got hung up on because he decided to do the full Middle English pronunciation. So I apologize, this is a pale imitation of his pale imitation that I remember from half a decade ago. The partner is effectively the man who sells indulgences on behalf of the Catholic Church in that era. You pay him money, he forgives your sins. So he's a bit of a scoundrel, and he's boasting about all of his con man ways, and he says he just shows off his papal bull. And then he does this so that no man may beast so bold, ne priest, ne clerk, me to disturb of Christ's holy work. And as you might have noticed, that doesn't sound exactly English. The way I heard it originally back in that day, which I probably very poorly replicated, was a very distinct Scandinavian twist, a remnant of that era where the Danes had control of most of northeast England. And I think an important element of that is this. We have a.
That point?
Yep.
Were the Danes in control of North England in the 1300s? When the Canterbury Tales were written?
No.
However, I must have misheard you then.
That's an important part of the pronunciation over time.
Oh, I'm
Now, I think this would be an extreme example of that situation that every person who studies English at all encounters. They're reading an old poem, and they see a phrase, and they think, how on God's green earth does this rhyme? They are unfamiliar with the sounds, and it's just distracting, it's confusing, and that's the same effect this Middle English pronunciation had. People were already struggling with the spelling, and suddenly they were just completely blown away by what they were supposed to be understanding. How does this have any relevance to us? What is the connection? This is not even English, basically. However, by being aware of the foreign language influences, I think that can desensitize people to this sudden shift that can exist in language. And for that reason, I think foreign language learning can indeed be a big natural, important, and necessary supplement to just current mandatory curricula. I thank you.
Thank you very much. So the third opposition is Tasha Mixpack.
Hello, members of the House. I heard a story a few years ago now that there were these two parents who knew a bunch of languages. So they had a baby together and they decided they were going to switch up the languages that they spoke around the baby to try to get the baby to learn as many languages possible in a really short amount of time. But the result of this was a baby that spoke a mix of all these languages and couldn't differentiate between them. Am I saying that compulsory learning of languages might make us all uncontrollably switch into other languages? Wee wee. Say quality. Also, just to point out,
how bad someone can be at languages. I let my friends who did French A-level, or one of them doing French A-level, read this, and they went, you spelled kwee-kwee instead of kwee-kwee. Yeah, so I don't hate learning languages. In fact, I even took Irish at GCSE. We're not saying that people shouldn't learn languages or that there shouldn't be funding given to languages. What we are saying is that language learning isn't for everyone. The proposition may point to other countries with exceptionally high rates of bilingual people, such as Germany or France, saying, look, they did it, so can we. But the reality is that the people in the area of Europe that these people are from a young age, are exposed to different languages and media and in their everyday lives. The English-speaking world isn't like this. We live in a bubble where everyone speaks English. If we were to make it compulsory to learn language up until GCSE, it would make very little change to us, and for a lot of people would be a waste of time and resources. Let's, for example, look at the average GCSE language class, which in my school wasn't compulsory, but it was recommended to take one, so almost everyone in the year did. I chose Irish, and I remember nothing. After 5 long years of studying Irish in that GCSE system, I couldn't string together a sentence. It is a miracle I passed that test. If you lack a passion for languages and don't have the enthusiasm to study a different language for a long time, then the effort of you having to go through a language at GCSE is going to yield no benefits in your life. I did it. No, thank you. I passed. I learnt nothing. And maybe if you have a bilingual parent or you can like spend money to go off to the Gaeltacht or whatever, you might be able to keep up your Irish, but just in every... Sure.
Spending money to go to the Gaeltacht comment, I don't feel like that's relevant at all. The Gaeltacht has nothing to do with mandatory language learning. That's something
I was
someone can develop separately.
Making it as a point of like, I don't get much contact with Irish outside of like that GCSE class, so now I can't keep up with it, if you get me. That's what I was trying to say there anyway. Beyond this as well, sometimes language learning at school can make your experience of school a whole lot worse if you don't want to do it. An example of this would be my own mother. She was forced into taking both French and Italian classes in school. Teachers in these classes didn't like her because she wasn't good at the subject and also she was dyslexic. So my mum dreaded going to these classes as they would single her out knowing she couldn't answer the questions, and no matter how hard she tried to learn the spelling, she wasn't going to be able to do it. So on Fridays when school started with double French and double Italian, she simply did not go in. She would skip school because it was better than being humiliated in class. So it created this endless cycle of not wanting to go to language classes as she was bad at them, and being bad at language classes because she didn't go to them, which then bled into the rest of her subjects, as skipping school altogether meant she was missing a lot of classes. If language learning is going to negatively affect you and the rest of your studies, is it really worth it? The system we have now allows for the students who like and are good at languages to study them, and allows those who aren't to do something else that they enjoy. No, thank you. Earlier, Terence spoke about how we could reassign foreign language teachers to speak to teach the English language instead of having a semi-illiterate English-speaking public. This is completely true. 16.4% of adults in England can be described as functionally illiterate, which basically means that they have very poor literary skills. They can read and write short texts about things that are familiar to them, but when it comes to longer, more unfamiliar topics, they struggle to understand. This causes a lot of problems, as you have a whole group of people who struggle to read the news, who are locked out of the job market, and as a parent won't be able to support their child's learning in any way. Should we not fix the problem within the English-speaking world instead of having people who couldn't write an essay but know how to say, this weekend I went to the cinema with my friends in Spanish? And Jake, I know you said that, oh, if we teach languages, it will enrich us, because I do English and I kind of know what you mean when you're reading poetry. You're like, that doesn't make sense. But for that to work every time, you would have to know so many languages, because as you said, I think it's like, there's all of our words from French, Latin, all of the Scandinavian languages. Would it not be a lot easier if we just brought in, I don't know, maybe like English language GCSE that actually worked and wasn't just something Sia pulled out of the bin? And they actually went, here's the Scandinavian influence on English, and it teaches you a little bit about pronunciation for the years, instead of just going learn every language that could have influenced English possible. Sure.
Couldn't we just have both? It would have to be,
they don't
have to be mutually
exclusive.
I know, but I'm just saying
that like there is definitely a problem with the English language that needs to be addressed before we can even go on to try and make anything else compulsory, because the whole thing is, if everyone is semi-illiterate in both things, it really doesn't do a lot of people a lot of good, and it would be a lot better if everybody just had really good literacy skills in at least one thing. No, thank you. Yeah, the English language GCSE is in every way a sham when it comes to learning the intricacies of grammar or even just a good standard of English. There's no discussion within it. It is made as a GCSE that everyone can pass so that you can say you have an English GCSE. To make matters even worse, here in Northern Ireland, there are schools that only have English language as compulsory and not English literature, or if you're dyslexic, they won't let you take English literature GCSE as they assume you will fail it. Meaning that there is no learning proper grammar, how to write an essay, or even analyse a piece of text. Should we not fix this glaring problem before we try to tackle people also learning a second language on top of this? I think to summarise tonight, a good saying would be that you can take a horse to water, but that doesn't mean it's going to drink it. We're not saying that languages shouldn't be giving the funding and attention that they deserve. We're just saying that language learning isn't for everyone, and the UK school system has so many problems that if we were to accept the proposition, what the proposition have put forward, we would have some happy students who like languages having a fun old time, and also some unhappy students who don't want to be there and aren't very educated in two languages now.
That's always boring me here.
I was
going to
say
we did this
a sample.
We're trying to teach kids German. We're not sending them to a gulag. Okay? You can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. But that doesn't mean you make all the other horses go without water. I think that's an important thing to just recognise just before we really get into this. I'm a Spanish speaker, so hablo esplandante. Esquil gourmet. And for those that haven't realised what I said when I say esquil gourmet, when I say bonsoir mes amis, when I say hola mis compañeros, I think the fact that a lot of those in the room tonight, and the fact that I can't even really pronounce it, is a ringing indictment of our current system. It is exactly the reason why it needs fixed. The point that the jump from GCSE to A-level is too much, Jesus Christ, I can relate. Going from fui al cine con mis amigos, I went to the cinema with my friends, 1 second, to Ramón Sender's Requiem por un campesino español, as you read a 1930s text about a man that lived in a village during the Civil War, and it was really weird and confusing, but it wasn't the Civil War, and there was these guys called señoritos, and they kept killing people. And the king was dead, but he also wasn't dead. And also, it's in this place that doesn't actually exist, in Aragon, which is a place in Spain, apparently. Now.
So, obviously you've done, I think you just mentioned it, Spanish A-level. Your side is saying to make language learning compulsory on par with English and maths, which means up to key stage 4, which is GCSE. Now you're complaining about the jump from GCSE to A-level language. So is it useful to take up the GCSE for further or not? Because you seem to be in contradiction of yourself.
I'm actually not, I'm glad you brought it up, because the reason that jump is so difficult is because we don't know what we're going to face. In the same way that if you jump from your standard Key Stage 3 English to GCSE English, the jump is not, you know, massive, it's not the Grand Canyon, because we've been learning English from we were about 4. If you're learning Irish or Spanish or French or German or Italian from age 4, you're naturally going to have a much higher aptitude, a much better ability for it by the time you reach that jump 1 second. You're also going to find it easier to do your other subjects. As pointed out by Professor Topping at the start, new neuroscience evidence has shown that children, and this is one from Penn State, from Professor Judith Kroll, has proved that multilingualists are better at multitasking. They can sift through information much faster. They can edit out information. They've got much stronger analytical skills. It actually has been proven that kids that learn languages and also learn to read music can actually see much greater development of their frontal lobe whenever it comes to... No thanks. The point of the lack of teachers, well, as I pointed out, DfE has shown that there are too many teachers in Northern Ireland. We have too many. That is a proven point. We've seen too many being trained. And yes, there is a lack of language teachers, absolutely. How do we usually learn to teach languages and become a language teacher? Most people go down the PGCE route. I've
top TGC students. They're really, really passionate about it. As pointed out again by Professor Topping, less people are learning languages. I wonder why that is. Probably because they're so intimidated at learning languages as GCSE and A-level, because they're afraid, because they don't have the backing in it, no thanks. They are told that they can't do them because they don't know, they're not ready for that. They're not ready for GCSE because we don't have a compulsory system in place. We haven't taught kids to learn languages in the first place. In the spirit of bilingualism, as you all know, I always wear a pure mental wristband. I wore one from the Loyal Orange Institution, which I really feel is in line with my bilingual and my Irish-speaking position. I also, the point of the fact that we're not exposed to other languages, Talcha, I thought that was absolutely brilliant. I know we're not exposed, but if you've got television, you can watch TG Cahir, you can watch France 24, you can also watch a variety of foreign language television shows on YouTube, on Sky, on Netflix. I mean, Jesus Christ, if you aren't exposed to it, go look for it. You don't have to be. You can walk down the street and you'll find an Irish language sign. Yes, I know it's controversial, but we have plenty to say about first year. I also, on the point, Terence, on Latin and your awful teacher. Latin's not a spoken language. No one really cares about Latin. Latin's an awful one. None of us are saying make Latin. Or like, because Latin's useless. We're talking about teaching kids to speak. Screw Latin.
Please don't put Latin in Irish and see what happens to you.
I can't imagine BT9 are going to beat me up for my Latin comments, but... I think she's definitely the Falls Road, Will. We don't need to put our kids through a broken system, because that is it, the system is broken. And as pointed out by Noah, I thought that was an absolutely brilliant point. Why do we not have more mandatory political education? I absolutely agree. It's something I truly believe in, but not mutually exclusive. You can do as I did. I did languages up to A level. I also did politics at A level. I now can talk about politics in Spanish and Irish.
You don't... Further information? So you've just said that you only started politics at A level, and yet what degree are you doing again? Because my actual POI is, my actual POI is the fact that do you study physics at primary school? Do you study chemistry at primary school? No, you start from secondary school and then you jump into A level. There's always a jump.
You actually are mandated under the curriculum to learn levels of science at primary school level. We learned it, so yeah, I did learn physics and chemistry and biology at primary school level, so yes, I did. I also just, the fact that there is a lack of bursaries for teachers, that's not because of language students, that's because of the Tories. Like, you can't blame us bilinguals for the Tory policy, other than...
Is it a point of clarification?
It's saying what...
Alright, yes. You're eating into my time,
right,
go for it.
My actual point is that, essentially, it's hard to get language teachers in to fulfil your plan because we've cut the bursaries and we've done various things, so how would we do it?
I mean, one of them, we could, you know, restore the bursaries. So, you know, bring back bursaries! Build back better, build back bursaries. The point that some students will find it as wasting their time. Have you ever shot and read of mice and men in a GCSE? Oh my god! Like, do you know how awful that is? Do you know how much of a waste of time that is? For a linguist? I don't give a damn about mice and men. And yet I still had to do it, because I still had to reach the qualifications that I needed to get into university. Of course it's a waste of time for some students, but for some it's really important. We need to be able to deliver. We cannot take these opportunities away from students. We have to make sure that primary school kids are equipped, developing properly, and the way we do that is making languages compulsory.
Let me get my timer up, please.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Chumapel Elie Chapita Belfast in Ireland du Nord. I spent 5 years doing French and another 3 in primary school, and that is all I can say, and I have an F at GCSE to show for it, and one less GCSE subject being allowed to take. I would also like to introduce myself as the little shit, as Kira referred to them in her class, as I sat in my French GCSE class after feeling I paid out of my own money, because I've worked from a young age, I paid out of my own money to get a French tutor because it was the only GCSE I was struggling with. They talked to me about dropping English literature, so I had more time to focus on French. I got a B in English literature. That would have been a real shame for me. So, I was the kid who did art in my French class, and at the end, towards the end of the year, I just got allowed to sit in the corner and do art because I was absolutely useless at the subject. I have absolutely no disdain for languages. My primary school, you learned Spanish from P1 to P7 for a half an hour a day and 2 hours on a Thursday. I went to a school where the languages that are compulsory from first to third year is French, German, Spanish, Latin, and Arabic. Then at GCSE, you can choose any of those 4. We also have the option to take BSL and Greek and Chinese and many other languages. And those clubs are very utilised because the school pays for you to take any qualifications in them if you want, which is really, really good. Now, my thing here is, history isn't a compulsory subject at GCSE. I agree. Geography isn't a compulsory subject. Typically, most schools get you choose between history and geography. RE in a lot of schools is not compulsory for a full GCSE. In fact, some secondary schools have it as a half GCSE, so it's actually a BTEC and you only sit it for 6 months in the first year. There are many subjects that could be compulsory that would be beneficial to be compulsory, but they're not. Why? Because we have so many other things to focus on, we have such a little timetable, and I also think that in the Northern Irish education system, I was lucky, I went to a grammar school, I understand that, but I'm also a working class student who didn't have the money for a tutor in every single subject, like my peers, and I suffered because of that. I would have personally benefited from being able to opt out of French. I never once passed any French test from my first day in first year. I had a history of always getting nothing above a 35%, and yet I was forced to take it for GCSE over chemistry, which I got a 93% in, over geography, which I got an 89% in. Those could have been an extra 2 GCSEs that I would have got an A or a B in. But no, I had to take one, so now I actually have 8 GCSE qualifications after being allowed to sit 9. That is a failure on my personal education. I am all 4 languages. My partner, on the other hand, went to a secondary school, as in non-grammar secondary school, and he did French from first to third year on Spanish. He's the one who helped me at my French GCSE. He chose not to do it, and he is glad for not choosing it because it gave him space to do something that he is now doing an HND in electrical engineering, and it's leading him to a nice salary. but language learning, in my opinion, when we are saying that it shouldn't be compulsory, we are not saying that secondary schools shouldn't have the funding to be able to teach it. I'm saying we should not force language teachers to have little shits like me in their classroom who are going to take up their time and they can actually teach dedicated students. Because I fortunately went to the second most funded school in this country. In Northern Ireland, my school is half state funded, half parent funded, and it's the second, you can look it up online by the way, how much money your school sits in the rank. Methody is the only one above my school for funding. We get so much money compared to state schools from the government, which that's a whole other issue. But opt-in system, if you have an opt-in system, that means you don't have to have as many languages. It's smaller classroom sizes. I do not need to code studies right now for my sociology level of the amount of the benefit that smaller classroom sizes have for education. If you have an opt-out situation, the Spanish class and German class, they were less prescribed to because the classes were in the less amount than French. Those students got, in my school anyway, much higher grades than the ones doing French because French was the typical one you were forced to do. Those students got more one-on-one focus time, more oral practice time, and a better learning environment. That is what we are for. We are not against languages here. We are for the betterment of students for their languages and being able to do GCSEs that benefit them. Now, I would also like to touch upon points that have been made by my side and the other side as well about working class students and working class schools and illiteracy levels. I went to a very, very, very good primary school. I went to a half church, half primary school thingy. It was very weird. The pastor was also the principal and there was a lot of money, but I cannot say one bad word about my primary school. Yes, we had a 15-minute prayer every morning, but that was it in terms of religious education. But we had amazing, amazing services, including Spanish, being taught to us. We also had, I had one-on-one physics and SEN learning because I actually, believe it or not, couldn't properly speak until the age of 9, and yet here I am. I couldn't pronounce the word to save my life. And that education was beneficial for me. Now, I had to opt out of my Spanish classes to get that opportunity. I wouldn't be standing in front of you, the debater I am today, if I hadn't in primary school been allowed to opt out of Spanish and have that focus time on my pronunciation, my phonics, and my spelling. In secondary school, it cost me a GCSE, and that shouldn't happen. And also, back to my point about working class students, sorry. In the area, the state I'm from, I was extremely lucky for my education. However, the local primary schools in my area, the P7s, out of 6 out of 10 are leaving P7 with a P3 reading and comprehension level, which is a disgusting failure on our state's part. Adding compulsory learning languages onto those teachers who are teaching massive classroom sizes, can barely cope with the workload, and are trying to help students who are in extreme poverty is not what they need. Instead, what we need is, yes, I do agree we should bring back the bursaries for language learning students, or PGCE. I want to go do a PGCE. There needs to be more bursaries. I have to go to England because we have too many over here, and I do philosophy and politics. But we need, there's too many teachers in Northern Ireland, there's not enough in England. England is a lot more stricter with their compulsory, and a lot more schools offer it because of the way their school system goes. And they have a shortage of teachers because no one wants to work in those conditions. So actually, to attract more teachers to be able to give students better one-on-one time, so the subject isn't as daunting, so more people choose French, smaller class sizes, more funding, and an opt-in system is better. Now, also on to my other point. I'm in my book today rather than my iPad, it's really throwing me off. one of the benefits of people, especially some of the opposition have for being able to speak their language is that they have a parent or guardian or someone in their family who speaks the languages. If you know any of your friends who are extremely good at languages, I will bet you a tenner that if you gather 5 people who are extremely good at languages, at least half of them, their parents know that language or know a language. That is, no thank you, that is extremely important in language learning for kids. It's not just Eldora. Like, it is actually needing to be from the parent to teach them that comprehensive skill, which most do not have. Now, I'm in the same boat as Harry. I also have to do Latin, and all I can do is a bassa, bassa, bant. It was a waste of my education. I personally support teachers. I don't want to give them overbearing workloads. I want to help languages thrive more, but there's an overall issue we need to face here. I'm making more things compulsory. Why not make history compulsory? Since you're saying it's not a be all and end all, why not make history compulsory, geography compulsory, all these other things that come into our understanding of the world compulsory as well? It's not doable. Thank you.
Quiet please, quiet please. Sorry James, we do not have time for questions this evening. It's already 9 o'clock. But I will invite...
No! 10 minutes.
But I will invite Professor Margaret to give closing statements for 2 minutes.
I feel slightly afraid to say anything here, actually, I have to say, but what I can say is that was wonderful, impassioned. I don't know if I've changed my mind, but I might have just a cop-out few words to say at the end. Terence, I loved what you said. I think your trauma might extend beyond life. We have a lot of services in the university that kind of... Okay, I loved what I hear. I've heard this evening. I'm going to very tentatively say that I think some of the arguments... Okay, I'm going to start by saying I'm biased, obviously. Some of the arguments that I heard for not learning languages, seemed not making them compulsory, seemed to me to be also arguments for making no subject compulsory. Saying language learning isn't for everyone, could we then say, well, numeracy isn't for everyone, literacy isn't for everyone, I don't think anyone's going to say that. What I really liked to hear on this side was the fact that language learning was not transactional. That's not what you were saying. You were saying that it's not just about I'm going to the cinema with my friend at the weekend. You were saying that it's about longing and belonging, not longing, belonging and culture and community. It's about cultural capital. It's about cognitive ability. It's about understanding yourself as much as understanding other cultures. It's about seeing the world through a lens that doesn't see English language and values as normative. Well, I am biased. So, denying people the opportunity to see the world that way, I'm very persuaded. Whether the answer to that is policy and make it compulsory or not compulsory, I'm not sure about that either. I think maybe the challenge comes back to us, as I said at the start, as language learners or language educators, to get a whole lot better at expressing the value of languages. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Professor. It is now our pleasure to turn our attention to the vote on speaker ability. Now, this is not a vote on what your perspective is. This is a vote on which side you think has spoken best at tonight's debate. So if you think this side of the room has spoken best at tonight's debate, you can raise your hand now. If you think this side of the room is spooky best, you can raise your hand now. So I'm going to put 4, 5.
8 is all.
We'll go 5. If you think... What? Oh, I'm quite in them.
4, 5.
5. I'd like to think they support their own side.
You're all
voting for your own side. Yes. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. 5, 5.
Stop the time.
You're right, 5. If you think this side of the room is spoke best, you can raise your hand now.
Thank you. By the way, learn languages. I'm fluent in French. It's a good thing to do.
If you want to abstain on tonight's motion, and now it's just us. Two abstentions. I can't. Do we have the quiet, please? Do we have the final numbers?
So, 5 votes for the proposition, 92 votes for the opposition, and 2 abstentions.